Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we sift through stacks of sources, articles, research, our notes, and pull out the most crucial insights, the real nuggets of knowledge for you. Consider it your shortcut to getting genuinely up to speed, with maybe a few surprising facts and hopefully enough interest to keep you listening. Today, we're diving deep into something that, well, it affects every single one of us, every day, climate change. And we're kicking off with a pretty stark reminder of its immediate impact. You might remember those awful flash floods in Central Texas, July 2025. Tragically, 27 lives lost at Camp Mystic. And this was despite emergency plans being approved just days earlier. Or maybe you recall New York's wild ride in 2024, a record 32 tornadoes, 8 days of extreme heat, even an earthquake. These aren't just, you know, random events. They're signs of a profoundly changing Earth system. So our mission today, to unpack the latest insights from the sources we've gathered, we want to reveal not just what's happening, but really why it matters directly to you.
We'll look at the alarming present, explore the systemic shifts happening under the surface, and then touch on the surprising power of our actions, both individual and collective. There are some genuinely eye-opening facts coming up, so let's jump right in. Okay, let's start unpacking this. Maybe you could ground us in the big picture first. Global temperature rise, what's the latest data saying about the increase and, crucially, the speed of it?
Absolutely. So the Earth's overall temperature has climbed by just over 1 degree Celsius since 1850. But here's the really critical part. The acceleration, it's speeding up.
Right.
The rate of warming since about 1982, it's been roughly 0.20 degrees Celsius per decade. That's more than three times faster than the long-term average over the previous century or so.
Three times faster. Wow.
Yeah. It's not a slow creep anymore. It feels like a rapidly accelerating trend. And what's really striking, I think, is that 2024 was, without a doubt, the warmest year since records began in 1850.
By a lot.
By a pretty wide margin, actually. Nearly 1.2 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average. And get this, the 10 warmest years ever recorded, they've all happened in the last decade, 2015 to 2024.
All of them.
Every single one. And in 2024, the global average temperature got really close to that 1.5 degrees Celsius mark above pre-industrial levels. You know, the threshold everyone talks about in international agreement.
The critical number.
Exactly. And just to hammer it home, April 2025 marked the 21st month out of the last 22, where temperatures were actually more than 1.5 degrees C above those pre-industrial levels.
Okay. And for anyone still maybe on the fence, the scientific consensus linking this to human activity seems, well, stronger than ever. What's the core evidence making that link unequivocal?
Well, the evidence is just overwhelming. Human activities, mainly burning fossil fuels, which releases greenhouse gases, are tagged as the unequivocal cause. It's stated as extremely likely to be the dominant driver.
Unequivocal.
It's not just seeing two things happen at once. We understand the physics, the atmospheric chemistry. We can track the isotopes in the CO2 back to fossil fuels. The models, the historical data, it all points to us.
Right. The human fingerprint is clear.
Very clear.
Okay, let's bring this down to ground level, specific examples. We started mentioning Texas. It's a tough but relevant case study. Beyond the Camp Mystic floods, you mentioned heat deaths in 2023.
Yeah, over 300 heat-related deaths in Texas in 2023. That was the highest number since they started tracking back in 1989, a grim milestone.
And that has ripple effects, right? Beyond the human tragedy.
Oh, absolutely. It's an economic hit, too. That summer 2023 heat wave. Estimates suggest it might have shaved a full percentage point off Texas's nominal GDP growth.
A whole point. How much is that?
Yeah. We're talking around $24 billion. It hit sectors across the board. Leisure, hospitality, agriculture, even manufacturing. It shows how heat impacts worker productivity, consumer behavior, everything.
And it didn't stop there. May 2024, another heat wave in southern Texas.
That's right. Heat indexes soaring past 110 Fahrenheit, huge strain on the power grid, rolling blackouts. And it wasn't just Texas. Those broader North American heat waves in 2024, they were linked to over 1,000 deaths in the U.S. and more than 150 in Mexico.
1,000 deaths.
Yeah. And there was an interesting analysis by Climate Central on a May 2025 heat wave in Texas.
What did it find?
They concluded that kind of early season intense heat would have been extremely rare without human-caused climate change. Millions of Texans felt what they called exceptional climate-driven heat. There's also this slightly counterintuitive factor, declining aerosols.
Aerosols, like from pollution.
Exactly. Cleaner air policies are good for health, obviously. But those pollutant particles actually reflect some sunlight, creating a slight cooling effect. As we clean up the air, we lose some of that masking effect, potentially unmasking more warming and contributing to heat waves, especially in populated areas.
Huh. Okay, so that's another layer. And it feels like these regional crises point to something bigger. You called it compound extremes.
Yes, exactly. Texas is a prime example. You get severe heat waves drying everything out, making conditions ripe for wildfires. Then you get intense rainfall causing flash floods. Sometimes these things happen close together or even fuel each other. It means just preparing for, say, a flood isn't enough anymore. You need a multi-hazard approach.
Right, looking at the whole interconnected picture.
Precisely.
And Texas isn't an outlier. Let's look in New York State. 2024 sounded like a real trial for them, too.
Oh, it was. A record 32 tornadoes for the state. 8 days of extreme heat. An earthquake, which is unusual there.
An earthquake, too.
Yep. Plus widespread flooding from the remnants of tropical storms, Hurricane Beryl, Tropical Storm Debbie, and just localized heavy downpours. It was a lot.
But wasn't there also drought? That seems paradoxical.
It is. That's the paradox. At the same time they were dealing with floods, much of the state faced drought conditions because of a historic lack of precipitation overall.
Wow. So too much water and not enough water almost simultaneously.
It really highlights the disruption to the water cycle.
Right.
The response was huge. 16 activations of the state emergency operations center, 35,000 utility workers dealing with nearly 3 million power outages, hundreds of emergency authorizations for rebuilding. It shows the strain.
And zooming out globally, is this pattern everywhere?
Largely, yes. Look at Latin America and the Caribbean in 2024. Glaciers disappearing, record-breaking hurricane season, devastating wildfires, like those in Chile that killed over 130 people.
Awful.
And debilitating drought in places like the Amazon and the Pantanal wetlands. River levels hit record lows. It's a global pattern of extremes becoming more extreme.
Okay, let's talk money.
Yeah.
Because all of this must have a massive financial cost.
It absolutely does, and it's escalating sharply. In 2024, the U.S. had 27 separate weather and climate disasters that each caused over $1 billion in damage.
$27 billion disasters in 1 year.
Yeah, second only to the record of 28 set just the year before in 2023. And those 2024 events led to at least 568 deaths, directly or indirectly.
And the total price tag for 2024?
Around $183 billion for the U.S. alone. That made it the fourth costliest year on record. If you look back since 1980, the U.S. has had over 400 of these billion-dollar disasters. The total cost. It's climbed past $2.9
trillion. Almost $3 trillion since 1980. That's hard to even process.
It is. And look at the acceleration. The average number of these events per year from 1980 to 2024 was about 9. But for the last 5 years, 2020 to 2024, the average is 23 events per year.
More than double the long-term average.
Significantly more.
So that nearly $3 trillion. What does spending that kind of money on disaster recovery do to a country's economy long-term, beyond just fixing the immediate damage?
It creates a huge systemic drag. Think about it per person. The five-year average cost of these disasters per U.S. resident went from maybe $150 back in the early 2000s to over $400 recently.
A big jump.
Yeah. And that money isn't just for repairs. It's money diverted from other things. Education, healthcare, infrastructure improvements, innovation. Plus, it drives up insurance premiums for everyone. And crucially, these impacts often hit vulnerable communities the hardest, making inequality worse. It's a constant drain.
Okay, so we've seen the visible disruptions. Let's dig a bit deeper into the underlying mechanisms. You mentioned climate change alters frequency and intensity.
Right. It's not just that the average temperature is going up. The whole distribution is shifting. Both average and extreme daily temperatures are moving higher. So what used to be a rare heat wave becomes more common. What used to be an unprecedented event, well, it happens. Warm extremes get more frequent, more intense.
And it's not just a simple linear increase, is it? There's something about magnification.
Exactly. It's a nonlinear. An extra half degree Celsius of warming might cause noticeable changes, but the intensity of extremes doesn't just go up smoothly. Projections suggest that the changes in intensity we'd see at 2 degrees Celsius of warming could be double what we see at 1.5 degrees, and at 3 degrees, maybe quadruple.
Quadruple. So each bit of additional warming packs a much bigger punch in terms of extremes.
That's the takeaway. It makes adapting much, much harder and more expensive with every fraction of a degree.
How well are the observed changes matching what scientists predicted? Are we on track, ahead, behind?
It's a mixed picture, but generally, the observed warming about 1.1 degrees C from pre-industrial up to the 2010-2019 period has tracked pretty closely, nearly spot on, with what earlier generations of climate models, like the CMIP3 series, projected for greenhouse gas-driven warming.
So the models weren't too far off.
For the general trend, no. However, there's some recent analysis, like from Hansen and others in 2023, suggesting a possible acceleration in the warming rate more recently. This might mean impacts are unfolding faster or perhaps more severely than some earlier consensus projections anticipated. We might be seeing that now.
Okay, let's talk sea level rise. That's one impact people often visualize. What's the latest there?
Global mean sea level GMSL has definitely accelerated. Back in the early 20th century, it was rising about 1.5 millimeters per year. More recently, say 2005 to 2015, that rate jumped to about 3.6 millimeters per year.
More than double the rate.
Yes. And in 2023, the average GMSL hit a new record high in the satellite era, over 10 centimeters. That's about 4 inches above the level back in 1993 when consistent satellite measurements began.
What's driving that acceleration mainly?
It used to be mostly thermal expansion, warmer water takes up more space. But now, the dominant drivers are the melting of glaciers and, crucially, the massive ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica.
And the projections. What are we looking at by, say, 2100?
Under higher emissions scenarios, the likely range is somewhere between roughly half a meter and nearly a meter, let's say 1.5 to 3 feet by 2100. But, and this is critical, scientists emphasize that a rise of 2 meters or even more by 2100 cannot be ruled out, especially if ice sheets become unstable faster than expected.
2 meters? That's over 6 feet.
Yes. And even more concerning is the long-term commitment. Because of the heat already absorbed by the oceans and the slow response of ice sheets, we're locked into significant sea level rise for centuries, possibly millennia, regardless of future emissions. A rise of over 3 meters by the year 2300 also cannot be ruled out.
Locked in. That really changes the perspective.
It does. It makes it an irreversible commitment, raising profound ethical questions about intergenerational responsibility.
Let's shift to something equally concerning. Feedback loops. Can you explain what those are?
Sure. Think of them as vicious cycles. Positive feedback loops in the climate system are processes where an initial warming triggers a response that, in turn, amplifies the original warming. They can make the system warm faster than just the direct effect of our emissions.
Okay, so they accelerate the problem. What are some key examples?
One major one is thawing permafrost. You have vast areas of permanently frozen ground in the Arctic and subarctic storing huge amounts of organic carbon.
Right.
As the planet warms, this ground thaws and the organic matter decomposes, releasing potent greenhouse gases like methane and CO2 into the atmosphere. This causes more warming, which thaws more permafrost. It feeds itself.
A classic feedback loop. What else?
Another big one is the melting Arctic sea ice, sometimes called the ice albedo feedback.
Albedo. That's right. Reflectivity.
Exactly. Ice, especially snow-covered sea ice, is bright white and reflects a lot of sunlight back into space. High albedo. The Arctic is warming much faster than the global average, 2 to 4 times faster. As that sea ice melts, it exposes the darker ocean water underneath. Dark surfaces absorb much more solar energy instead of reflecting it, so the ocean warms up more, which melts more ice, which exposes more dark ocean. You get the idea.
Another accelerating cycle.
Precisely. Then you have forest fires and carbon release. Warmer temperatures and more frequent droughts create conditions for larger, more intense wildfires.
Mm-hmm.
These fires release massive amounts of carbon stored in trees and soils directly into the atmosphere. Plus, they damage or destroy forests, which are crucial carbon sinks, reducing their ability to absorb CO2 in the future.
So fires both release carbon and weaken our natural defenses.
Yes. And finally, consider ocean warming and CO2 absorption. Oceans absorb a huge amount of the CO2. We admit they're a massive carbon sink, but warmer water holds less dissolved gas, including CO2. So as the oceans warm up, their capacity to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere decreases. This leaves more CO2 in the air, further enhancing the greenhouse effect and weakening this vital natural buffer.
It's the way these things link together that's really unnerving, cascading effects.
Absolutely. They're interconnected and can create non-linear responses.
And the fact that our natural carbon sinks, oceans, forests, soils, which currently soak up about half our emissions, are themselves being damaged by climate change. That seems critical.
It is. It's a major concern. If those sinks weaken significantly, atmospheric CO2 levels could rise much faster.
You hear warnings about the Amazon rainforest potentially flipping from a sink to a source of carbon.
Yes. That's a real risk being studied intensely. Deforestation combined with warming and drying trends could push parts of the Amazon past a tipping point, possibly within the next decade or so, where it releases more carbon than it absorbs.
And I read something about plastic pollution impacting ocean carbon uptake, too.
That's another emerging concern. Microplastics can harm phytoplankton and algae, which are the base of the marine food web and responsible for a huge amount of carbon fixation through photosynthesis. If their populations or efficiency are reduced, it could impact the ocean's ability to act as a carbon sink.
Okay, this leads us directly to the idea of tipping points. You mentioned them earlier. Can you define those more clearly?
Sure. Tipping points are critical thresholds. Once you push a system past that threshold, even a small additional nudge can trigger a large, abrupt, and often irreversible shift to a completely different state. Think of it like leaning back in a chair. You can lean back so far, but there's a point where you suddenly tip over and you can't easily get back.
Points of no return, essentially.
That's a good way to think about it. Scientists have identified around 16 potential tipping elements in the Earth system. And what's particularly alarming is that recent research suggests the temperature thresholds for triggering some of these might be lower than previously thought. Some could potentially be at risk of being crossed even at global warming levels as low as 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial.
Wait. But you said earlier we've already passed 1 degree C warming in recent years and even approached 1.5 C.
Exactly.
So what does that imply?
It implies that we might already be dangerously close to or potentially even past the triggering point for some of these major shifts. The exact thresholds are still uncertain, but the risk is undeniably present and growing with every increment of warming.
Can you give some examples of these potential tipping points?
Sure. One major one is the potential collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. If that goes unstable, it could eventually contribute up to 3 meters. That's about 10 feet to global sea level rise over centuries.
3 meters.
Another is mass coral bleaching and die-off. Warming oceans and acidification are pushing coral reefs towards collapse globally. They support huge biodiversity and coastal protection. Also, the potential die-off of large parts of the boreal forests, the vast forests across Canada, Siberia, Alaska, changes in temperature and precipitation, plus pests and fires, could trigger large-scale transitions.
And the key word here is often irreversible, right?
Largely irreversible on human timescales, yes. Once an ice sheet collapses or a major ecosystem transforms, it wouldn't just snap back even if temperature stabilized. It presents a profound challenge ethically, politically, for how we manage risks with potentially devastating long-term consequences.
Okay, beyond these big potential shifts, how is climate change disrupting the fundamental natural systems that regulate the planet day to day, like ocean currents?
Well, the oceanic circulation is definitely being affected. We talked about the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, that big conveyor belt.
Right, the one that affects Europe's climate.
Exactly. Observations suggest it's been weakening over the last 15 years or so. The concern is that melting ice sheets, releasing large amounts of cold freshwater into the North Atlantic, could slow it down significantly or perhaps even disrupt it abruptly. That would have drastic impacts on weather patterns globally. Although, intriguingly, some research suggests rising temperatures in the Indian Ocean might temporarily boost the AMOC. It's incredibly complex.
But not straightforward.
Not at all. And it's not just the Atlantic. Pacific Ocean currents are also observed to be accelerating, and some warming patterns seen in the tropical Pacific don't quite match what many climate models predict. It shows we still have much to learn about how these vast ocean systems respond.
What about the global water cycle? We touched on the flood-drought paradox.
Yes, that's central. Climate change is intensifying the water cycle. A warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, about 7% more per degree Celsius of warming.
Okay.
So when it rains, it can rain harder, leading to more intense downpours and increased flood risk in many areas. But that same higher temperature also increases evaporation from land surfaces and water bodies.
Leading to
more rapid drying of soils and more intense prolonged droughts in other regions. Or even in the same region at different times, it exacerbates both water scarcity and water-related hazards. Remember, over 2 billion people already lack safe drinking water, and about half the world's population faces severe water scarcity for at least part of the year. And satellite data shows overall terrestrial water storage, groundwater, soil moisture, snow has been declining globally over the last 2 decades.
That sounds like a fundamental stress on societies.
It absolutely is. Water is essential for everything.
And it goes deeper still, down to the basic chemical cycles.
Indeed. Climate change impacts the biogeochemical cycles. The movement of essential elements like carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, water through the Earth's living and non-living systems. Changes in temperature, precipitation, CO2 levels directly affect things like photosynthesis, plant growth, decomposition rates. This alters how these elements cycle, which in turn affects ecosystem structure, function, and their ability to provide services, including regulating the climate itself, like carbon cycling.
Which brings us back to the natural carbon sinks.
Exactly. As we've said, oceans, forests, soils are vital. They absorb about half the excess CO2 humans pump out. But they are under pressure. Deforestation, destructive agriculture, pollution, and the direct impacts of warming itself, like those forest fires, or reduced ocean absorption, are actively damaging these sinks. It reduces their capacity to help us, meaning more of our emissions stay in the atmosphere, accelerating warming further. It's another one of those worrying feedback loops.
And finally, the direct impact on living things, biodiversity, and ecosystems.
Climate change is a fundamental threat here. Species are responding in various ways. Some adapt, some shift their ranges, some decline, and some face extinction.
We hear about animals moving north, for instance.
Yes, there are observed geographic range shifts. On average, land animals studied have been moving poleward or uphill at rates equivalent to about 6 kilometers or nearly 4 miles per decade. Marine species are moving even faster, averaging over 27 kilometers or 17 miles per decade.
Wow, that's quite a shift.
It is. And then you have phenological mismatches.
Meaning?
Things happening out of sync. Like the spring bloom of plankton might shift earlier due to temperature cues, but the fish species that rely on that bloom for food might respond to different cues, like day length, and arrive too late. Or birds arriving at their breeding grounds after their main insect food source has already peaked.
Disrupting the whole food web.
Exactly. It disrupts critical interactions. Climate change also facilitates the spread of invasive species like lionfish, expanding their range in the Atlantic, which can outcompete native species. All these disruptions undermine ecosystem resilience and their ability to provide essential services, from food production to carbon storage.
Okay, this paints a pretty stark picture of the global scale. It can feel overwhelming. But let's pivot to the role of personal action. How much do our individual lifestyle choices actually matter in the grand scheme of things?
They matter significantly. Our individual choices, how we live, travel, eat, what we buy collectively, shave a very large portion of the planet's overall carbon footprint. Think about it. Home energy use, transportation, our diets, the consumption of goods and services. These are the main contributors to an individual's emissions.
And you mentioned a figure for North America.
Right. In North America, something like 85% of the population has an annual carbon footprint exceeding the global per capita sustainable threshold, which is estimated around 4.6 tons of CO2 equivalent per year. CO2 equivalent, or CO2e, just bundles all greenhouse gases into one metric based on their warming potential relative to CO2.
Okay, so most people in North America are above that sustainable level.
Uh-huh.
But here's something that really jumped out at me from the sources, a study about the impact of high emitters.
Ah, yes. That was quite revealing.
It suggested that if just the top segment of global emitters, roughly the wealthiest 24% of the world's population, made concerted lifestyle changes, they could reduce household consumption-based emissions by a massive amount.
That's right. The study estimated a potential reduction of over 10 gigatons of CO2e just from that group changing consumption patterns. That represents about 40% of the total household carbon footprint across the 116 countries studied.
40%? Just from the top quarter making changes. That really reframes the potential impact, doesn't it? It suggests targeted action by high consumers could have a disproportionately large effect.
It does. It highlights that while everyone has a role, the responsibility and the potential for impact are not evenly distributed. And beyond that specific study, broader analyses show that lifestyle changes alone across populations could cut global energy demand by maybe 5% by 2030 and 10% for 2050 compared to business as usual.
10% by 2050 just from lifestyle shifts.
Yes. And if you combine those lifestyle changes with ambitious policies to decarbonize the energy supply and improve efficiency, the potential reduction in energy demand could reach as high is 35% by 2050.
Okay, so the synergy is powerful. Let's get practical. What are some specific, quantifiable actions people can take, starting with energy efficiency at home and renewables?
Well, bigger ticket items like improving home insulation or switching from fossil fuel heating to an electric heat pump can make a huge difference, potentially cutting your footprint by up to 900 kilograms of CO2e per year.
Nearly a ton.
Yeah. And switching your electricity supply to renewable sources like wind or solar, either through rooftop panels or utility programs, can save even more, up to 1.5 tons of CO2e annually. But smaller things add up too. Reducing heating and cooling settings, switching all lights to LEDs, washing clothes in cold water, line drying instead of using a machine dryer, these all contribute.
Okay, what about sustainable transportation? Flying and driving often come up.
There are major factors for many people. Living completely car-free, if feasible, offers the biggest savings, potentially reducing your footprint by up to 2 tons of CO2e per year.
2 tons just from ditching the car?
It's significant. Even shifting some trips to public transport makes a difference, saving maybe 3-4% of household emissions depending on usage. If you need a car, switching to a fully electric vehicle can save up to 2 tons of CO2e per year compared to a conventional gasoline car. A hybrid offers savings too, maybe up to 700 kilograms per year.
And flights?
Air travel, especially long haul, has a very high carbon footprint. Taking just one less long haul return flight per year can cut your footprint by almost 2 tons of CO2e. Choosing trains over short-haul flights where possible also helps.
Okay, next big area, dietary shifts. How much impact does changing what we eat really have?
Quite a bit, actually. Shifting towards a more plant-based diet is consistently highlighted as impactful. Adopting a vegetarian diet can reduce your personal carbon footprint by up to 500 kilograms CO2e per year. Going fully vegan can nearly double that saving, up to 900 kilograms CO2e per year.
Almost another ton for going vegan.
Potentially, yes. Another way to look at it is that shifting to a healthy vegan diet might reduce total household emissions by over 8%. And remember the bigger picture. The entire food system accounts for roughly a third of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. And within that, animal agriculture is the dominant contributor responsible for maybe 75% of food-related emissions. So reducing meat and dairy consumption is a powerful lever.
Right. And finally, conscious consumption. This feels broader. What does it involve?
It's really about challenging the buy new, throw away culture, embracing the classic hierarchy: reduce, reuse, repair, then recycle.
So reducing consumption first.
Exactly. Buying fewer new things in the first place. When you do need something, considering secondhand options, repairing items instead of replacing them. And finally, recycling properly. Think about plastics. They generated almost 2 billion metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions back in 2019 throughout their life cycle. And less than 10% of plastic waste actually gets recycled globally.
Less than 10%.
Yeah. So reducing plastic use is key. Studies also show that reducing the use of commercial services can cut household emissions significantly, maybe around 11%. And repairing appliances or participating in sharing economies instead of everyone owning everything can cut another few percent. It's about being mindful of the resources embedded in everything we buy and use.
Okay, those are some concrete actions.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a potential catch I've heard about: the rebound effect. What is that?
Ah, yes, the rebound effect. It's an important consideration. It refers to the phenomenon where the money you save by making an energy-efficient or low-carbon choice, say, by insulating your home or driving less, doesn't just disappear.
You spend it elsewhere.
Exactly. And if you spend those savings on other things that are also carbon-intensive, like maybe taking an extra flight because you saved money on your energy bills, then some, or even much of the original carbon saving can be canceled out.
How much can it offset?
Some studies estimate that this rebound effect could offset anywhere from a significant fraction up to potentially 45% or even more of the initial gains from efficiency or conservation measures.
So nearly half the savings could be lost if you're not careful about where the saved money goes.
Potentially, yes. It highlights that achieving deep emissions cuts requires not just adopting specific low-carbon technologies or behaviors, but also a more fundamental shift in overall consumption patterns and potentially conscious choices about how we use any financial savings. Sustained behavioral change is key.
That's a really crucial point. It's not just about the initial action, but zooming back out, even with the rebound effect considered, individual actions clearly have potential. How do they connect with the bigger picture of collective and systemic change?
They are intrinsically linked. Individual action is necessary, it's powerful, but it's often insufficient on its own to drive the scale of change needed. The sources emphasize the synergy.
Synergy, meaning they boost each other.
Yes. One perspective offered is that without broader systemic changes, supportive policies, infrastructure, technological innovation, individual lifestyle changes might only realize about 10% of their true potential for climate action.
Only 10%.
That's one estimate highlighting the dependency. The other 90% of the potential requires enabling frameworks put in place by governments, businesses, and wider society.
So individual action needs supportive systems to flourish.
Absolutely. Policy and industry have a, quote, massive role to play in making sustainable choices the easy, affordable, and default option. Think about policies that promote remote work, reducing commutes, incentives for plant-based diets in public canteens, building codes that mandate high energy efficiency in homes, infrastructure for walking, cycling, and public transport. These systemic changes enable and amplify individual efforts.
And when institutions act collectively, like schools or hospitals.
That's another powerful amplifier. When large organizations adopt sustainable practices, say a hospital system committing to serving more plant-based meals or a university divesting from fossil fuels, it normalizes these behaviors, creates economies of scale, and sends strong signals to the wider market and society. It magnifies the impact far beyond the sum of individual choices within that institution.
There's also a psychological dimension mentioned in the sources, right? About how to engage people effectively.
Yes, that was interesting. It suggested that simply bombarding people with more reports and statistics on climate change might not be the most effective way to motivate action.
What works better then?
The suggestion was to focus more on investing in shared identity and progressive values, working through trusted community networks, giving people a sense of belonging, and importantly, collective agency, the feeling that acting together can make a real difference.
So less about abstract data, more about shared purpose and community.
That seems to be the implication. Building social movements, fostering a sense that people like us are taking action, and making sustainable choices socially desirable and normal could be more powerful drivers of change than just factual knowledge alone.
Okay, we have covered a huge amount of ground today. Let's try to recap the key takeaways. We've seen the planet is in a state of profound, accelerating climate flux. This is driven by systemic disruptions, amplified by these dangerous feedback loops that are pushing us closer to potentially irreversible tipping points.
That's right. The evidence for human-caused warming is unequivocal, and the impacts from record heat and extreme weather to rising sea levels and stressed ecosystems are already severe and widespread.
But critically, we also explored the other side of the coin. We saw the very real, quantifiable impact that individual lifestyle choices can have, especially concerning energy, transport, diet, and consumption.
And we emphasize that while individual action is vital, its true potential is unlocked when it's combined with and supported by collective action and systemic changes driven by policy and industry. They work hand in hand.
So looking ahead, addressing this challenge seems to demand a two-pronged approach, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It requires both robust mitigation, that means deep, rapid cuts in greenhouse gas emissions across all sectors to limit future warming as much as possible, and proactive adaptation.
Adaptation meaning?
Meaning building resilience to the climate impacts that are already happening and those that are now unavoidable due to past emissions. This involves adjusting our infrastructure, economies, and societies to cope with the changing conditions. Ultimately, building a resilient future demands these integrative strategies. We need technological innovation, yes, but also these profound lifestyle transformations we discussed, all underpinned by strong policy frameworks and a renewed sense of global commitment to looking after our planet.
Okay, a lot to consider. We always like to end with a final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Given everything we've discussed today, especially the concept of irreversible multimillennial impacts like sea level rise that are already essentially locked in by our current and past emissions, what does responsibility truly mean? What does it mean for the choices we make right now, today, not just for ourselves or even our grandchildren, but for generations living potentially thousands of years in the future who will inherit the consequences of our actions? Something to think about.